Hello there. You're in the Philosopher's Zone. Good to have you with us again. Today, what does it mean to go extinct?
I think that's one of the issues I'm interested in taking up. What does extinction show us about how we think about the world at large? And I think one of the things it shows us is that these concepts of nature and the natural world are somehow removed from our daily lives or from what it is to be human. So I think paying attention to extinctions shows us how we're actually tangled up with the non-human world, the more than human world.
Tom Van Duren, working at the edge of extinction. More from Tom later. It's said that we're in the sixth mass extinction. If predictions hold true, we'll see the end of many species within the next few centuries. So some serious thinking is going on to make visible a difficult concept. What does it mean to go extinct? The answer is not what you might think. In fact, as Audra Mitchell sees it, it's beyond a simple matter of life and death.
Yeah, I mean, why I say that is I'm trying to dislodge this popular belief that mass extinction is death writ large, right? That it can be reduced to or explained by thinking about death, you know, on a large scale. So what I'm saying is that extinction is actually a negation of both life and death, right? Of the continuity of these life processes and ultimately of the processes of evolution. So when I say it's not just a matter of life and death, I mean it's not only a matter of life and death. I'm not suggesting that extinction is necessarily worse or higher than death in a metaphysical sense. But what it does mean is that it's different from death. And this is a problem if we continue to treat mass extinction as if it's just a matter of death on a large scale. This leads to a number of distortions. So one of the big ones I'm thinking about is this idea that we can stop or at least slow down extinction by managing life and death processes. And this really comes from the idea of biopolitics or even necropolitics, which are really, really important in security thinking. I mean, this you can see these kinds of politics in all of the major current responses to extinction, whether we're talking about conservation or forced breeding of certain species in captivity, and even the colonization plans to colonize other planets in order to escape extinction on Earth for certain species. So the idea behind all of these strategies is that humans can intervene in the processes of extinction and ultimately to divert them in other directions that are more normatively desirable to humans. And this is really about humans making decisions about being and non-being. But basically, this kind of biopolitical control only works by channeling these processes of life and death, by using them as raw materials. And as I've argued, extinction actually negates these processes. So this suggests that most of the existing responses to mass extinction don't really fit with the reality of what's going on.
The reality being that it's a very big thing, a thing that is difficult to imagine. Is this what you mean?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of things there, a couple of issues. One of them is the inability of humans to apprehend mass extinction, whether it is their own extinction or mass extinction as a general phenomenon. And one of the things I'm very concerned with is that these two things are often treated as if they're separate, right? As if human extinction is something that is in some way separated from the extinction of other beings on Earth. I mean, the concept I've been using quite a lot is Timothy Morton's notion of the hyperobject. Now, he argues that hyperobjects are distributed massively over time and space, so they still cohere as objects, but only at scales that are very difficult for humans to access, even, you know, with high-power microscopes or modeling systems and supercomputers. I mean, one of the big issues with hyperobjects is this idea of temporal scale. So we're in the middle of a mass extinction event right now, or it's at least scientific consensus seems to suggest that. But most people aren't immediately aware of this. And this is because it's unfolding over decades and even centuries. And even when there are phenomena of mass extinction that unfold, say, within a human lifetime, it's hard for any one person or group or organization to see it. So, for instance, the WWF just released a report stating that 52% of biodiversity was destroyed between 1970 and 2010. But this, of course, was scattered across decades and across the world. It's very hard to get a glimpse of it as one event. And so this is what Morton's saying, is that we can only see what he calls phases of a hyperobject. We can't grasp the entire event. So we could see the death of an individual and, you know, any kind of organism that was believed to be the last of its kind. But this doesn't mean that we would be seeing mass extinction. And another issue with even thinking about this is that obviously trying to contemplate our own extinction is a real problem. One of the most popular books on mass extinction has been Alan Weisman's The World Without Us. This is a book of, well, it's a fictional book, although it's often sold in non-fiction sections, that tries to imagine what the world would be like if every human suddenly disappeared. Now, the problem with this is that even in trying to show a world without humans, it assumes a human subject, a subject that can see and is concerned with the human world, or the world as modified by humans. And Claire Colebrook has written some interesting things about this recently, about how subjectivity is transformed by mass extinction and by contemplating the end of humanity. And she argues that we're already witnessing the extinction of a certain kind of humanity, that Cartesian notion of the human, and that this actually opens up possibilities for other ways of being and other ways of being human and otherwise. But again, this doesn't help us to deal with this idea of the physical or the material extinction of humans. So those are the kind of problems that we run into when we're even trying to think about what extinction is. And I think that it's really important to do that, because since discussions of mass extinction started around the 1980s, it's been taken for granted, particularly in scientific discourses, that it means the loss of species. But some of the work I've been doing recently suggests that mass extinction actually produces different kinds of subjects as well. So there's a lot of issues and questions around that.
Different kinds of subjects? What sort of subjects?
Well, for instance, the embattled human, right? The human as the subject of extinction. Also, there's another category that I think is given very little attention, which are what I would call abject subjects of extinction. So those are the subjects that we wish would go extinct, right? These are usually animals that are seen as pests, but it could also be plants. For instance, there's a lot of talk of invasive species that upset ecosystems. I know in Australia this is quite a big issue. The idea that humans have transferred in species that ultimately undermine and threaten species that are seen to be more valuable.
Yet that would be seen as a positive thing. Again, it comes back to this managerial aspect of passing judgment on what should live and what should not. And on a practical level, that is seen as a good thing, isn't it?
Well, it depends who you are. I certainly think that those who have a managerial approach, particularly conservationists, or those who are interested in preserving certain valued forms of life, would think that that's a good thing. And of course, this idea also ties into the belief that humans alone are responsible in the universe for deciding on existence. So, I mean, I think that the problem with this is that it's so deeply anthropocentric, in the sense that we will try to protect and preserve those beings that we see as being either aesthetically desirable or as instrumentally desirable in terms of creating lifestyles that dominant humans perceive to be valuable. So because we don't have access to other lives, and arguably even if we did, we might not take those into account when making decisions about being, there's a real power relation that emerges out of this, a real domination of other kinds of species that, to me, goes well beyond biopolitics. It's a kind of ontopolitics of deciding what gets to live and what gets to die, as you said.
Back to the big, or should I say hyper-object side of things, the extinction at that level. One of the things that you say is that it's particularly a problem for Western secular humans. What does that mean, and why is it a problem?
Well, it's a problem because Western secularity has essentially taken tasks that were, or that still are for many people, and traditionally have been associated with the divine, and putting them in human hands. Now, the reason that this is a problem is because it places this massive responsibility in human hands that it's really unrealistic for humans to be able to achieve. The other reason why it's a problem is because Western secularity doesn't really offer any kind of framework for understanding either death or understanding being and non-being. And again, it's important to keep the two separate. Within Western secular discourses, death is the end. That's it. You know, there's nothing more to be done with it. The only way that we have of recuperating death in a Western secular framework is to commemorate it, or to create processes that in some way celebrate life or valorize the ongoingness of life. And of course, mass extinction negates the ongoingness of life. It suggests that everything is ephemeral, that all forms of life will essentially disappear without a trace or without many meaningful traces. And again, because it isn't a transcendent framework, Western secularity doesn't really have much to say about non-being. It's a real black box within Western secularity. So again, this isn't necessarily a bad thing. I'm certainly not suggesting that we need to have a transcendent framework for understanding mass extinction. but it definitely offers fewer assurances and fewer resources for people to draw on when they're thinking about how they might respond to an event like mass extinction.
Mm. And this takes you back to your point of evaluative terms like harm, injustice or wrong, building an ethical framework around this. Firstly, if you could just explain why words like harm, injustice or wrong do not do the job when trying to come to terms with mass extinction, and where one might start then with a new evaluative ethical framework.
Sure. Well, I mean, I think the one of the really common threads running through all of those terms is that they're all deeply humanist and deeply anthropocentric. I'll just take harm for an example. Within existing definitions of harm, it's understood that it is the human subject that can be harmed. So that's one of the problems, is that the anthropocentric notion of harm simply can't encompass those beings that are affected by extinction. And if you did try to stretch it that far, it would have very little meaning. It would have basically do no work as a concept within global ethics. The other problem, as I've mentioned before, is that we can't necessarily make black and white distinctions between extinction being good and extinction being bad. So we were talking about invasive species before. As you mentioned, for some people, the extinction of these species would be a very, very good thing. Of course, if you were looking from the perspective of those beings, or if you were looking from the perspective of a community that valued them more, it would be a very negative thing. So it's very, very difficult to adjudicate between what is normatively harmful or not harmful. There's also the problem of scale, right? I mean, this is the kind of problem that motivated the thinking behind the concept of genocide, for instance, was that this was a problem that was too big to be captured within any existing laws at the time or any existing legal norms. So the notion of genocide was, came to suggest that it wasn't just the deaths of individuals that mattered, but also something higher, something bigger. Now, again, I'm not sure that the right way is to go down that kind of metaphysical pathway to suggest that that mass extinction is the death of Platonic categories or ideals, etc. But I do think there is something to be said about trying to visualize mass extinction as a collective problem. One of the issues is when we look at the way that mass extinction is presented, particularly by organizations that are trying to do something about it, they tend to show images of an individual animal or of a particular species. And this gives the impression that species or even individual animals are dying one at a time. So what I want to argue is that actually this is a global collective problem, that it's not just about things going extinct one by one, but that it's actually something more broad, not to say universal, but much more collective than that. So what I'm working on is trying to develop a framework that is both interdisciplinary and pluralistic. So right now, I mean, there's quite a lot of, for a good, few decades, there's been a lot of research on the sixth mass extinction, extinction patterns of particular species and on the phenomenon as a whole. And more recently, we've seen a really exciting surge in contributions from the arts and humanities, art festivals on extinction, literature on extinction, and some wonderful new work in the anthropology of extinction. So I think we need to bring these discourses together. Right now there's a bit of a conveyor belt between scientific research going straight into policy making. And what we need to do is to pluralize these understandings of what extinction means, how it's experienced by a range of not only humans, but other beings around the world. And so that's where techniques like multi-species ethnography come in as well. Yeah, so this is the kind of work that I think is necessary to move forward thinking about global ethics of mass extinction.
Audra Mitchell of the University of York on the power of many perspectives to make sense of a big and scary idea. This is the Philosopher's Zone on RN.
All of my work is really guided by a single question in a way, which is, what does it mean to live in a time of extinctions?
Environmental philosopher Tom Van Duren. He works with endangered birds, and he's been thinking about life and death when the going gets tough. What he provocatively calls violent care.
Well, that really came out of fieldwork that I did. So my philosophy is perhaps a little bit unusual in that it's all grounded in fieldwork and also grounded in real engagement with biology and ecology and ethology. So the questions that I try to take up really emerge out of the field. So one of the things that I noticed in captive breeding facilities, where I first started to think about this, was that there's certainly a lot of care going on, a lot of concern for these birds at the edge of extinction, but coupled with violence in a lot of cases. My colleague Maria Puig della Bella Casa has done a lot of very interesting work on care in the human context, and she makes very clear that care is not always rewarding or comforting, that in her words, it's a practical labour. And so when you go beyond abstract well-wishing to the real labour of care, it's often a very compromised and complex practice. And so when we care for endangered species, there are always winners and losers, and I was interested in who loses, I suppose.
And the term violent, why violent care?
In part, I was hoping to be provocative, and I think that certainly the response I've had from some biologists who I share this my work with, and I'm often writing about their daily labours of care, some of them have found the word violent confronting as well. But I'm trying to take in a broad range of violences, if you like. Sometimes it's the species that we actually care for, individuals of those species who are exposed to violence, who are forced to live in diminished conditions, who are exposed to sort of to ongoing artificial insemination, where they're held in the corner and inseminated. So there's a lot of stress often and other things associated with that. So there's often a violence that's very intimate to the ongoing care of the species. And sometimes it's about making individuals live for the good of their species. But in addition to that, there's the sort of further violence that draws in all of these other species, whether it's potential predators or competitors in the environment who need to be culled or killed or otherwise thinned out to make room for an endangered species. So I'm interested in not allowing the violence to slip out of view, in fixating on the people who do very good work caring for species, but so to make that violence more visible, to make us accountable for it, and to work towards forms of care that are less violent, ultimately.
This is an interesting philosophical cut here, because there's obviously another way of looking at it, which is, you know, we should be a lot more neutral and inert and move away from the so-called natural world. It's a different philosophical stand.
Definitely. And I think that's one of the issues I'm interested in taking up. What does extinction show us about how we think about the world at large? And I think one of the things it shows us is that these concepts of nature and the natural world are somehow removed from our daily lives or from what it is to be human is very misleading and problematic. So I think extinctions, paying attention to extinctions, shows us how we're actually tangled up with the non-human world, the more than human world, in very intimate ways. And so I've looked at that at an ecological level. I've looked at the way that disappearing species threaten people's cultural practices, the way that the disappearance of vultures, for example, has caused many people view as the breakdown of the Parsi funerary system that traditionally relied on exposing their dead to vultures. So humans and nature, if you like, are always already tangled up. I think the idea that we don't have some sort of responsibility and that we should just leave nature to itself, especially in the midst of an anthropogenic extinction crisis, is, I think, very misguided. Although it is a view that is widely...
It's a common sense view, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. Not a very helpful view, I don't think. So I think my work is really grounded in an approach that takes the entanglements of humans, ethical entanglements, biological, in terms of how the world that we inhabit is a meaningful world. In all of those ways, I think we are inextricably entangled with nature. And this long history in the West that's been analysed by a whole range of environmental philosophers, my favourite being Val Plumwood, Australian ecofeminist, who I think really showed us the problems with these dualistic thinking about nature over here and culture over here, and how that leads to a very dangerous way of understanding our place in the world that covers over all of the ways in which we're dependent on environments and all of the ways that we're made who we are, whether it's through coevolution with other species or through very intimate food chains, all of the ways in which life is possible. All of that leads to, I think, a fuller sense of who these species are and so of what is lost in extinction. And those specifics, I think, give rise to a range of ethical questions that are really practical questions about how to live with others. I start with specific birds or specific other species, drawing on biology, ecology and ethology, the science of animal cognition and behaviour, to try and get a sense of what are these ways of life that we've brought to the edge of extinction? How do these birds hunt or reproduce, or in some cases, how do they mourn for their own dead? All of that leads to, I think, a fuller sense of who these species are and so of what is lost in extinction. And those specifics, I think, give rise to a range of ethical questions that are really practical questions about how to live with others. And so the ethical questions that I take up sort of emerge out of those practices of thinking through not just what these ways of life are, what it is to be a Hawaiian crow in some sense, but also how is the Hawaiian crow tangled up with other species, with plants that it's an important pollinator for or seed disperser, but also with human communities, with Native Hawaiian cultural practices.
Because I know that you've just been working on the Hawaiian crow. What is that interdependence with the culture?
Oh, there's a wide range of different ways. The Hawaiian crow has a long history of Native Hawaiian stories. Its feathers were used once traditionally. And it's part of that general landscape of plants and animals in Hawaii that make life meaningful, that carry stories for Native Hawaiian people. But in the contemporary context, one of the things that's really interests me is how the project to restore the crow, which requires in some cases the fencing off of large areas of forest and the killing of all of the pigs inside that area to allow the forest to regenerate so that the crows have something to eat and somewhere to hide from hawks who would otherwise kill them. So there's aspects of this violent care there in that situation. But it's also meant that the effort to restore the Hawaiian crow has sometimes brought that project into conflict with some Native Hawaiian people who talk about the pig hunting as a traditional cultural practice and don't want to see more fences go up in forests, don't want to see pigs being excluded. So it's not always peaceful, and these views aren't always in alignment. And so this is part of the reason why I think the fieldwork is so important, to really explore these sites at the edge of extinction that are often very fraught and complex. Yeah.
In relation to that, I think you quote, is it Donna Haraway, staying with the trouble is a way of being able to illuminate these issues? That's what you do, stay with the trouble?
Yeah. So in some of Donna Haraway's recent work, she's developed this idea of staying with the trouble, and also her work on sharing suffering. She's thinking about a world in which there are no easy answers, I suppose. We are embedded in these relationships, interspecies relationships, and we need to find the best possible ways of inhabiting them. So part of that idea is about moving away from what Derrida calls a sacrificial logic. And Haraway takes up those ideas to look at how we often justify away the deaths of non-human animals. It's for the good of the species, or it's for the good of the development of a new medical product. And so we can become comfortable with killing others.
Those evaluations are probably all true to some degree, though, aren't they?
This is the sort of fine line, if you like, between justifying away violence and dwelling within its complexity. And I think what Haraway is asking for, and what I'm asking for in my work on captive breeding facilities, is a way of living with others that may well involve suffering and may well involve killing, but that never allows that to become easy. And so as a result, one of the practical consequences of that is that we have to always be looking for ways to care in less violent ways, to make captive breeding facilities better, whether it's through enrichment that has been going on for a long time in zoos and other facilities, not always well, but trying to make captive lives better. And sometimes we don't see the same emphasis in captive breeding facilities, where these animals are really just seen as sort of slaving away for the good of their species. So part of, I think, the work of staying with the trouble is making those practices better. And partly it's also about making them visible. And the whooping crane in the US is a great example, where every time there's a migration and we see the ultralight aircraft leading these young cranes on their first migration, it's viewed as this kind of humans and our technology in this kind of very salvational role. But there's a lot that goes on behind the scenes. And so we really do view it as a very redemptive, salvational role that we're playing. But there's a lot of violence that makes that possible. And so I think making visible what life is actually like at the edge of extinction is very important.
environmental philosopher Tom Van Duren from the University of New South Wales. His extensive fieldwork was published earlier this year as a book called Flightways, which chronicles the intimate lives of endangered birds, including Indian vultures, Hawaiian crows, and closer to home, little penguins. More details on our site. Thanks to the team this week, Diane Dean and Charles McCune. I'm Joe Gelonesi. See you next week in the Philosopher's Zone.